Copyright notice. The contents of this podcast, including intro music, are copyright Phantom Femme. The podcast artwork is copyright Isabeau of WAGProductions.org. This labyrinth, the Phantom of the Opera, in Eric's times and ours. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 9, of In This Labyrinth. I can't believe we're at episode 9 already. That being said, though, should I even bother at this point apologizing for how late this episode is? Or is that, like, just becoming a taken-for-granted fact? Oh, good heavens. I will anyway, though. I am really sorry this episode took so long to get out. I had hoped to have it up and posted much earlier than this. But life had other ideas, as it tends to do. First of all, I had to mark my student second assignments, because as some of you know, I'm doing my PhD, and with that comes teaching assistantship jobs. So yeah, there was that. It wasn't as bad as it could have been, thank heaven, because our prof had the inspiration to have the students do group projects, so that at least meant there were less than 50 papers to mark this time, which was very much appreciated by all concerned. But there were still a pile of papers to mark, and of course, this being December and lead up to the holidays, and I imagine lots of listeners out there experience this too, December is a really busy month. It's fun, for sure. I've had a wonderful time doing all kinds of Christmas stuff with my family and getting ready for the holidays. But even so, yeah, it's been busy. And then, on top of that, I got a cold. I'm over it now, thank heaven. Although, yeah, you might hear some remnant congestion in some parts of the episode. But there was definitely a week or so there when recording was a thing that was just not going to happen. But the result of all that was to add up, yet again, to major delays getting this episode out. So, yeah, really sorry about that. All that said, though, in spite of all the delays, I'm apparently over 200 downloads now. So, thank you all so much. That is awesome. I'm totally floored to see my downloads picking up so fast in spite of all my difficulties actually keeping to schedule. So yeah, huge thanks to everyone out there who has downloaded or is downloading and listening to all the previous episodes. And thank everyone for tuning in for this new episode. And I hope you enjoy it. So, as I said in the previous episode, I thought I'd go easy on myself and do something that didn't require a huge amount of research this time. So, this episode is a book review. And I'm going to be doing a bunch more of those book and fanfic reviews over the next couple of episodes, just to keep things easy and doable. But, yeah, this episode is a review of a self-published fanfic novel, and as such, I should say now, warning, This episode does contain spoilers. Not hugely, I definitely don't give the entire book away, but yeah, there are some spoilers. I thought I should probably mention that. Also, content warning for mild discussion of depression, suicide, and sexuality. Later in the episode, the discussion is very mild, mostly because I didn't want to give too much of the book away, but yeah, it is there, so yeah, just content warning for that, just in case. So as I said last time, in this episode, I want to discuss and review Louise Ann Bateman's novel, The Angel's Shadow. It's a self-published fanfiction novel that originally came out in Kindle ebook and paperback format back in 2014, but it's had a new version come out just this year, which is why I wanted to review it for this podcast. And also because, I'll say right now, I love this book. I've read it like 4 times now. And I must say, part of the reason that I do is not only is Bateman's writing excellent, which it is, but also she's done something which I really wish more self-published fanfic authors would do. She's released it in audiobook, which is just so incredibly awesome and wonderful. Because, don't get me wrong, I love my original LaRue novel audiobook dearly, but it is still incredibly wonderful to have more Phantom audiobooks to listen to than just that. So yeah, I was super delighted to see Bateman's book released as an audiobook, and I'm super thankful and grateful to her for putting it out in that format. And yeah, as I said, I know it's a major undertaking and probably an expensive one, but I really wish that more fan authors, more Phantom fan authors, would do that. And what is more, and I have to say, Bateman gets a 5-star rating right off the bat just for doing this. Not only has she released the book in audiobook, but it's a fully cast dramatic reading. So there's different readers voicing each character, and the casting is superb. I can't think of a single performance in the book that doesn't absolutely nail it. Although I will say there are some that are especially fantastic that will get specific shout-outs later on. And the production values are impressively good too, especially for what I understand to be a pretty much self-produced audiobook. I mean, yes, there are some spots where fast-paced dialogue comes dangerously close to overlapping, to having the tracks overlap, but really, that's just being nitpicky. Honestly, it's as good as any professionally produced audiobook I've ever bought, production-wise. And that's saying a lot because I freely admit to being something of a snob when it comes to audiobook production values and readings. So, as to the contents of the book, it's a retelling of the events of Phantom, told in first person from the point of view of Meg Giry, who is read, excellently I might add, by the author herself. It actually begins a couple of months before the main events of Phantom take place, with the Phantom rescuing Meg Giry from a nasty little incident in the streets of Paris, and then spends some time building up their relationship before getting into the main Phantom plot. And no, it's not a Meg/Eric, that Meg/the Phantom romance. Angel Shadow is the first book in a series, so that may be where the series is going later on. But if it is, you can't tell it from this, the first book in the series. If anything, for the most part of this first book, Meg's and the Phantom's relationship would best be described as frenemies. They do build up a grudging trust and friendship over the course of the book, but they also, as Meg puts it early on, butt horns a lot. But I'll get into more detail about that later. So, once the book gets into the main Phantom plot, then the sequence of events pretty much follows that of the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical. So, for example, the chandelier crash comes at the end of the opening performance of Il Muto, as in the stage version, not in the middle of the opening of Don Juan Triumphant, as in the Jerick. Similarly, like in the stage version, the decision to use Don Juan Triumphant to try to capture the Phantom comes before Raoul has the confrontation with the Phantom in the graveyard. Bateman does, however, draw on the Jerick for a lot of details within scenes. So, for example, the dress rehearsal of Hannibal scene very much follows the version of that scene in the Jerick. Similarly, the aforementioned confrontation in the graveyard also very much follows the version of that scene in the Jerick. Although there, as in elsewhere in the book, Bateman's actually tried to blend elements of the Jerick and the stage version. So, for example, in the graveyard confrontation, she has the Phantom shoot a couple of fireballs down at Raoul from the top of the mausoleum, but then when that doesn't phase Raoul, he leaps down and begins the sword fight, as in the Jerick. And, as I said, she does blendings like that in other places in the book as well. And, okay, personally, I would have preferred she stick to the stage version, but that being said, she actually does a really excellent job blending the two. She really makes it work. She also relies heavily on the Jerick for her characters' backstories as well. So, for example, like in the Jerick, she has Christine be orphaned at like 6 or 7 and come to the opera house as a young child, and be living in the dormitories there ever since. Although her Phantom's backstory is kind of hybrid, it's kind of halfway between the Jerick and the stage version, in that she has him come to the opera house and take up residence there as a youth, as a teenager, rather than as a young child like in the Jerick. But she still has Madame Giry, although in this case an older and already married Madame Giry, rescue him from an abusive gypsy fair. Now, obviously, personally I would have preferred, again, for her to stick to pure stage version, going to LaRue as necessary for character background. But again, I have to say that she's made the blending of stage version and Jerick work actually really well, better than I would have thought it would. And, amazingly enough, Bateman also incorporates a number of elements of LaRue as well. So, for example, she borrows that scene from the LaRue novel in which the Persian tries to cross the lake, runs afoul of, quote-unquote, the siren, nearly drowns, and is rescued and then chewed out by Eric for having tried to cross the lake. But in this case, Bateman has Meg be the one who tries to cross the lake and runs afoul of the Phantom's defenses and gets chewed out for it. And also, Bateman's version of Christine's first visit down to the Phantom's lair and her unmasking of him is a really interesting blend of stage version and LaRue, which, again, you would think would be hard to make work, but Bateman does, and it comes off brilliantly. And one of the ways she pulls off this really interesting three-way blending of stage version, Jerick, and LaRue is that throughout the novel, there are little phrases which are nods either to passages from LaRue and or to lyrics from the musical. And I have to say, that's one of my favorite things about the novel. Those bits are such delightful little Easter eggs for a fan. Before getting to what else is great and interesting about the book, though, because there's a lot, I want to take a moment to give a shout out to some particularly spectacular performances, because, as I mentioned at the beginning, the audiobook version of Angel's Shadow is not only an audiobook, but a full-cast dramatization, unabridged too, which is fabulous, and there are some particularly stunning performances in it, so I want to give a shout-out to those before going on any further. So first of all, as I mentioned before, the author herself reads the main narrating character of Meg, and she really nails her characterization of Meg, which might seem obvious given that she wrote it, but not all authors read as well and expressively as they write. But she does, but Louise Ann Bateman does. She really does a great job of bringing her Meg to life. And then I also really love the choice of reader for the character of Christine. She has a lovely warm voice, actually warmer and richer than Louise Ann Bateman's own voice, which is a bit thinner and more kind of prim, but it works. It really works in terms of conveying the two characters, because the Christine reader really conveys the fully blossomed, beautiful young woman, but who's still very warm and sweet and innocent. Whereas Bateman's Meg is in some ways still a little girl, and in some ways still trying to stay a little girl, but more on that later. In the meantime, I have to say that although I am, as you've probably noticed, not a Raoul fan, I really liked this Raoul. I really liked the reader for Raoul here. He really nails the young, sort of idealistic, very earnest, knight in shining armor wannabe. And he made me, at least, actually like this characterization of Raoul kind of in spite of myself. And then, last but not least, the guy who reads the Phantom. The guy who reads Eric. Because although this story is stage version based, is ALW based, one of her nods to LaRue is that Bateman gives her Phantom the name Eric. And the guy who reads him is amazing. And I don't say that lightly, because I've heard some damned amazing Phantoms in my time in various different versions, and he's right up there with the best of them. Because first of all, this guy is a superb actor. Wow. He absolutely nails the emotion of the character all the way through and makes the Phantom that he portrays both compelling and sympathetic. He makes the Phantom both very charismatic and very sympathetic. And that's super impressive because he actually has quite a wide range of emotions to cover. Because on one hand, Bateman's made her Phantom, I have to say, a bit darker and more violent than I would normally be comfortable reading, but she makes it work, and this guy's performance makes it work, too. You believe him when he's playing the Phantom's dark and violent moments. But Bateman also shows her Eric's tender side, and this guy's performance absolutely captures that. And also, you absolutely believe him that he is desperately, head over heels, hopelessly in love with Christine. This guy manages to absolutely convey that in his voice. And on that note also, and particularly high praise, he absolutely nails the emotion of the final lair as well. And the way Bateman's written it, which I have to say she did beautifully, the final lair, because of course it's stage version based, so Meg doesn't actually see the final lair. She hears about it afterwards through Eric's narrating of it. So he has to get that right. And as I said, this reader, the chap who reads the Phantom in this, absolutely nailed it. Wow, it was incredibly powerful. And just as an aside, in spite of what you might think from a blind person, there are actually very few times when I've found a person's voice, just their voice, straight up hot. But, this guy's is. He has a beautiful timbre to his voice and beautiful, crisp diction that comes with certain kinds of English accents, but without it sounding in the least pretentious or put on or snooty. And thinking about it later, his voice and diction actually kind of remind me of Colin Firth. At least as I heard Colin Firth in that great BBC Pride and Prejudice series way back when. although I think this guy might have a slightly deeper voice, but he has the same kind of lovely, crisp diction. Although, I have to say, as charming an actor as Colin Firth is in that series, I never found his voice as straight-up sexy as I find this guy's. No offense to Colin Firth fans out there. But I think that's because, or perhaps it's just the way it's mastered in the recording, this guy's voice has just a slightly darker quality. And of course, that works beautifully for Phantom. Especially since, as I mentioned, Bateman's emphasized her Phantom's dark side quite a bit in this rendering, and she's also very strongly emphasized his sexuality. Indeed, to get back to talking about the book itself, one of the things I found the most interesting about Angel's Shadow is the way it deals with and kind of relates the issues of madness, mental health, normalcy, and sexuality. Because in this telling, in Angel's Shadow, Meg's late father was quote-unquote mad, was what the 19th century would have called mad. We today would say he suffered from severe depression. And in fact, we learn early on in the book that Meg's father committed suicide because of his depression, and that really shapes Meg's character. It's a driving force in Meg's character throughout the entire book. Because on one hand, of course, she misses her father. She misses the loving father that he was both before his depression set in, and, of course, during the times when it lifted, during the spells between his bouts of depression. But on the other hand, she's also, and at the same time, angry with her father for having committed suicide, for having quote-unquote left her, and she's angry at God and at Eric and at the Phantom for having not prevented it, for having not stopped him. And why she's mad at Eric for that is explained later in the book. But on the third hand, and this is where normativity comes into it, Meg dreads ending up like her father. Her greatest fear, especially as she begins to experience bouts of depression herself, is that she will, quote-unquote, go mad and end up in an insane asylum and or end up committing suicide like her father. And this causes Meg to, unconsciously but very strongly, kind of identify with normalcy and project all abnormality out onto Eric, out onto the Phantom. And that causes her to have a really interesting, complicated, ambivalent relationship to Eric. Because on one hand, she's very drawn to him, but not in ways that are obviously sexual or romantic, even to the reader. Although there may be tiny hints of that, but it's hard to tell if one is reading that into it or not. And they're certainly not obviously perceived as sexual or romantic. The way she's drawn to him are not obviously perceived as sexual or romantic by Meg herself. She reads her draw to Eric as being that Eric reminds her of her father, and so she understands herself as kind of looking to Eric as a kind of a warped father figure. But on the other hand, she's very frightened of Eric long before he actually gives her any real cause to be. And I kind of read Meg as being frightened of Eric because he is quote-unquote abnormal. And not only his face. In fact, she doesn't find out about his face until Christine tells him about her experiences in the lair. She doesn't even guess that he's hiding a deformity or disfigurement. She just reads his behavior, his wearing a mask and his hiding and living inside the opera house, as abnormal and therefore as suspicious. As I said, even before he's actually given her cause for fear or suspicion. And because of that, Meg also reads Eric's interest in Christine as inherently suspicious, long before Eric's actually given her cause for that. And this is where I find that Louise Ann Bateman's done a brilliant, though I'm guessing unintentional, job of portraying what might be called the cycle of normalized suspicion. Because Meg, brilliantly portraying and representing the normative gaze, sees the Phantom, labels him as abnormal and suspicious because of the way he presents. As I said, even before he's given her any actual cause for fear or suspicion, and in fact, when he's given her every cause to trust him, because, recall, Meg's very first encounter with Eric is in fact when he saves her from an attack. But then, because Meg's decided that Eric is abnormal and scary and therefore suspicious, she not only becomes curious about him, but she feels she has the absolute right to that curiosity and to pry into his realm and into his secrets and into his business. And she often justifies it to herself and to Madame Giry by claiming concern for her own or her mother's or Christine's safety. And then when Eric reacts to her prying with hostility and anger and tries to scare her into stopping her prying, it only confirms to Meg that he's dangerous and suspicious and needs to be kept a close watch on. And I have to say that the first time I read the book, this kind of made me want to smack Meg upside the head. Because it makes her come across as a little bit self-righteous, and that's a little bit obnoxious. But that could be because that aspect of the book particularly resonated with me, because that's a cycle that disabled and, I would imagine, disfigured / deformed people and other marginalized people actually do experience a lot, being regarded with suspicion and fear even before you've actually done anything, and then having your desire for privacy, personal space, respect taken not as a desire for privacy and respect and personal space, but in fact as confirmation of guilt, confirmation that you have something to hide, confirmation that you're suspicious or that you need to be kept a close eye on. Or just written off as you being quote-unquote resentful, quote-unquote, about your disability, deformity, whatever. And so fair game to override and ignore. And so while I definitely grant that some of the lengths Eric went to try to frighten Meg off were way extreme and wrong, I could really relate to his being pissed at her prying and her curiosity and wanting to try to enforce his boundaries and get her to bloody well respect them. And on that note, Angel Shadow ought to win some kind of award for containing the best answer to an intrusive disability question ever. It cracked me up. I killed myself laughing, and I only wish I would ever have the nerve and the right context to actually use it. Because there's this moment in the book where Meg just blurts out to Eric, "Can I see your face?" And they're nowhere near close enough for her to have any right on God's green earth to ask that question, and it makes you kind of want to smack her upside the head again. And, of course, you expect Eric to be furious and to fly into a rage, but that's not what he does. Instead, he very calmly and matter-of-factly fires back, "Can I see your genitals?" And, of course, Meg is totally affronted and outraged and incensed. But he's just given her a perfect taste of how personal and intimate a question that is, and just how far she's overstepped by asking it. And I have to say, I absolutely love that part, because of course, as disabled people, we get intrusive questions like that all the bloody time. how much can you see, how much can you feel, what happened to you, those kind of things that people have no bloody right to ask, but do anyway. I mean, total strangers have no right to ask, but do anyway. Unfortunately, I don't think the angel shadow response would work as a comeback to any of those questions, because the connection between the response and what they asked wouldn't be obvious, wouldn't be clear, but bummer, because it would be great. Although, as I said before, I'm not sure I would actually have the nerve. I kind of hope somebody out there would, though. Maybe some of my wheelchair-using friends who, as a blind person, I don't get this question much, but my wheelchair friends tell me they do. People like mild acquaintances and even total strangers asking them if and how they can have sex. Like, seriously, people ask this shit. People ask this shit who have no bloody business asking this shit. And the angel shadow response would work in that context. It would work as a response to that kind of question. Just as an aside, given how visual, like, flirting and all that is in our culture, now that I think about it, it actually surprises me that I don't get that question. And maybe other blind and visually impaired people out there do, but I haven't yet, and no one I know has yet. Like, I mean, none of the blind and visually impaired folks that I know have yet. Anyway, just an interesting contrast to, as I said, my physically disabled, especially wheelchair-using friends and acquaintances from whom I hear that they get that question all the bloody time. Unfortunately, actually using the angel shadow response would probably get you charged with harassment these days, but bummer, because, as I said, I love the way it puts the shoe back on the other foot and makes the person asking the totally rude, overstepping, intrusive disability question feel the kind of discomfort they've put the disabled person slash deformed slash disfigured person in. So, yeah, back before I was saying that one of the really interesting things about the novel, about the book, is the way that it kind of explores the connections among mental health slash madness, normativity, and sexuality. And it does that through Meg's character and through the characters of Eric, Christine, and Raoul. Because, as I mentioned earlier as well, Bateman has emphasized her Eric's sexuality. I mean, there are lines he won't cross. He says early on in the book that he would never force himself on Christine or any woman, and as a reader, you believe him, at least I did. And in the final Lair retelling, of course, as in the Lloyd Webber musical, he owns up to his inexperience. But within those parameters, he has a perfectly healthy, if thwarted, if frustrated, sexuality. And this is part of what freaks Meg's character out about him so much. And it's really interesting the way Bateman's contrasted Meg and Christine here. Because she's portrayed Christine, and the voice actress captures this wonderfully, as innocent and sweet and pure, but not repressed. You know, we learn later on in the book that Christine's nervous about her wedding night with Raoul, but she's not terrified. She's looking forward to, as she says, learning together with him. Whereas Meg is terrified of sexuality, hers and anybody else's. Now, granted, that could most definitely be because of the attack that the Phantom saves her from at the beginning of the book, and Bateman makes clear that that's certainly part of it. But she also makes clear, at least it seemed to me that she did, that that's not all of it, that there's more to it than that. Because although Meg says right at the beginning of the book that how she got to where she was attacked, that the Phantom saves her from, is because she snuck off into Paris on her own at night out of frustration at being 16 years old and having never yet experienced so much as a kiss. And, as an aside, I have to say that Bateman does a great job of portraying the patriarchy here as well, because, of course, when the Phantom rescues her from the attack, and when Madame Giry later finds out about it, of course Meg is totally blamed and shamed for it. She's not accused of being a slut, but she's certainly accused of being irresponsible. But yeah, in spite of Meg's expressing of frustration at being so sheltered at 16 years old, you get the sense throughout the book that romance is really an abstraction to her. Her notions, her ideas of love and romance come from what she's seen in operas and read in books, but you get the distinct impression that Meg's never felt romantic attraction toward, or much less physical desire for, someone herself. In fact, when Christine tells Meg about her reunion with Raoul after the Hannibal Gala, Meg sort of wistfully envies Christine and wonders if she herself will ever, quote, feel the blush of romance, unquote, which gives you to understand that she hasn't yet. And honestly, she comes off as a bit of a prude. The locker room talk of the other ballet girls just shocks and appalls her, and any evidence of men's desire just disgusts and repulses and frightens her. So, of course, when Meg becomes aware of Eric's desire for Christine, it totally adds to her suspicion and mistrust of him, and to her fear of him, and helps her justify to herself her curiosity and prying. And it makes it hard for Meg to see Eric's feelings for Christine as real love. She eventually does realize that, yes, Eric really, truly does love her. But by that point, it's past the graveyard confrontation and we're well into the preparations for the opening of Don Juan Triumphant and Christine's engaged to Raoul, and it's kind of late for that. Whereas for the rest of the book leading up to that point, Meg is kind of convinced that Eric's feelings for Christine must only be lust and desire and possession. Whereas, in spite of the reputation that aristocratic men had with regard to young, beautiful singers and dancers of the opera, Meg recognizes Raoul's love for Christine immediately and trusts Raoul's love for Christine immediately. Partly because of what Christine's told Meg about their childhood together, but also because Raoul presents like a knight in shining armor out of one of her operas and storybooks. He presents, and again the reader captures this beautifully, kind of like a very earnest puppy. Very young and earnest and tame, and without a hint of whatever physical desire he may have for Christine. And this, it seems to me, makes Meg see Raoul very early on in the book as the obvious choice for Christine, as the obvious and right choice for her best friend. And if Angel's Shadow were not the first book in a series, I would say that was a pity, because had Meg been a bit more mature and broad-minded, she might have been able to help Christine sort through her feelings for both Eric and Raoul a lot sooner, and at least come to the place where she could have compassion for Eric, if not, though maybe even, return his love and desire. However, it is the first book in a series, so as I said before, I will be very interested to hear where the series goes from here, because Angel's Shadow gets us to the end of the canon plot. It gets us to the end of where the Lloyd Webber musical / Jerick leave off. So after that, we're into wide open sequel territory. And I'll be very interested to see where Bateman takes it. Because, as I said, the sort of obvious assumption is that it's going toward a Meg-Eric romance. But at the same time, I'm not totally sure that would be a correct assumption. Because from where they leave off at the end of Angel's Shadow, yeah, both Meg's and Eric's characters have a long way to go before that could happen. So I'll be very interested to see where this goes. And just as a final comment, Book 1, Angel's Shadow, ends on something of a wicked cliffhanger. I won't give away what it is, but yeah, I heard it and was kind of like, what? You're ending the book there? What the? So yeah, I'll be very interested to hear what happens next for that reason as well. So I hope you've really enjoyed this discussion of The Angel's Shadow by Louise Ann Bateman. And as I said, I would highly, highly recommend this novel, especially the dramatized audiobook version, to any Phantom fan out there. Although, caveat that it can be a bit dark in some places. But still, it's an excellent book and an excellent audio dramatization. I loved it. And you can get it on Amazon Kindle, and of course you can get the dramatized audiobook version of it on audible.com. And I believe you can get it in hard copy on Amazon as well, and I'll put those links in the show notes. I mean, the actual show notes this time, the long description of the episode, not the blog. Just to make them as easy as possible to find. And, better yet, Book 2 of the series, which I believe is called Angel's Flight, is already out now, I believe, in hard copy and on Kindle, and should be coming out very shortly, if it's not actually already out by the time this episode drops, in audiobook as well. And best of all, I gather from the author that it's going to be read by the same cast, which is super awesome, including the same guy reading the part of the Phantom. I haven't had a chance to read, or rather listen to, the sequel yet, but I can already say I would highly recommend it. And I'm certainly planning on listening to it as soon as I possibly can, and reviewing it here as well. So yeah, something to look forward to sometime in the early part of the new year. So, on that note, I really hope everyone out there has enjoyed this episode as much as I've enjoyed recording it and, of course, reading for it. And, as always, I would very much love to hear folks' responses and reactions and thoughts on this episode or any other episode. And there are all kinds of ways that you can contact the show to do that. You can, of course, tweet at the show at ITL Podcast, and of course you can follow the show on Twitter at ITL Podcast. You can also like/follow the Facebook page for the show and or join the Facebook group for the show, both of which you should be able to find by searching In This Labyrinth on Facebook, and they're both named the full title of the podcast, In This Labyrinth, The Phantom of the Opera in Eric's Times and Ours. And there's a link to the Facebook page on the podcast website, and there's supposed to be a link to the Facebook group on the Facebook page. I thought there was, but apparently I did it wrong, so it didn't work. But I will fix that as soon as possible, so there will be a link to the Facebook group on the Facebook page. Oops, sorry about that. What can I say? Me and technology sometimes butt heads. Yeah, so the URL for the podcast website, then, is https://inthislabyrinth.fireside.fm/. And, of course, you can also send an old-fashioned email to inthislabyrinth@yahoo.com. And, last but not least, the show is also up on both iTunes and Google Play, so you can also leave a rate and review there. And it would be lovely if folks would, because of course that will help boost the show and make it more searchable and make it easier for more listeners to find it, which would be awesome. So yeah, I would be very grateful if folks would subscribe on iTunes and Google Play and leave rates and reviews there. Thanks. So once again, I really hope everyone out there has enjoyed this episode. And I hope to have the next episode out sometime in early to mid-January. And as I said, it'll be another review, either a fanfic review or a review of a really interesting book that I stumbled across earlier this year called Phantom of the Opera, A Social History of the World's Most Popular Musical. So hopefully folks will enjoy that either way. In the meantime, I wish all of you out there the most wonderful holiday of whatever variety you celebrate. And may phantom delights sing songs in your heads till next time. Disclaimer: the opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and do not reflect the views of the host, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Cameron McIntosh, The Really Useful Group, or any other person or entity. In addition, this podcast is not in any way affiliated with Andrew Lloyd Webber, The Really Useful Group, Cameron McIntosh, or with any other person or entity involved in the production of any version of Phantom.